Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 319 for June 4th, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
I think there are a lot of whiskey drinkers out there that don't know they're whiskey drinkers yet.
That's Chip Tate, one of the founders and chief distiller at Balcones Distillery in Waco, Texas. Last time around, I mentioned Chip's new Balcones Brimstone Whiskey, which is smoked over Texas scrub oak wood. It turns out there's more to the story, though. Chip will fill us in a few minutes. I'll also have the emails of the week, the calendar of events, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First off, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned the new labels going on Jack Daniel's whiskey over the next few weeks. There's been a lot of debate since then over why certain things were taken off the labels, but the distillery's hometown of Lynchburg, Tennessee still has a prominent place on the bottle. After all, it's not like Brown-Forman could just close down the distillery and make Jack somewhere else, right? That's exactly what some Tennessee politicians have in mind. Nashville Public Radio reports State Representative Dave Alexander will sponsor a bill next year to tax the barrels used to make Jack Daniel's whiskey, after county commissioners in Moore County voted to request the tax. The distillery is the biggest and literally the only industry in Moore County. It's Tennessee's smallest county. And supporters of the tax say the distillery's fleet of heavy trucks damage county roads and bridges, and the barrel tax could raise $5 million a year to pay for the repairs. Brown-Forman has not weighed in on Alexander's plans yet. Keep in mind that, as the Jack Daniel's folks have mentioned many times over the years, their distillery is located in a dry county. As I've reported before, there are only three distilleries working right now in Ireland, but a fourth could be open within 2 years. Belfast lost its last distillery 75 years ago, but the owners of the Belfast Distillery Company plan to have their stills fired up within 2 years. They launched Titanic Irish Whiskey last week, 100 years after the launch of the Titanic from a Belfast shipyard. Managing Director Peter Lavery is behind the project. He's also responsible for the Danny Boy Irish Whiskey brand. More new whiskeys to mention this week. Glengarry is releasing a 1994 vintage that's going on sale this month in the UK. It was laid down just before the distillery was mothballed in 1995 for a couple of years and has Glengarry's old-style smoky notes. It's also one of the last bottlings using barley malted on-site at the distillery. It's been bottled at a cask strength 53.9% ABV and will be available in the U.S. in September. Meanwhile, the Macallan is releasing a new expression in its 1824 collection Travel Retail Series. The MMXI, Roman numerals for 2011, is bottled at 48.2% ABV. Just 1,824 bottles are available, right now primarily at airports in Asia. And last fall, we heard about Woodford Reserve's Master's Collection Maplewood Finished Bourbon. It has crossed the ocean now and is available in limited European release. Finally, here's an update on last week's conversation with Laphroaig's John Campbell on the wider release of the Kerchase Illioc following its debut at the Islay Festival last week. The official word on U.S. availability came out Friday. It'll be available this month in Illinois, New Jersey, New York, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Washington, with only 1,800 bottles available in the U.S. And that's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. Just a couple of weeks left until the WhiskeyCast Father's Day giveaway. Our sponsors will be sending out special prize packs to a few lucky WhiskeyCast community members. The prizes include a micro-fleece jacket from Ben Romick, golf goodies from Glenmorangie, and travel bags from Johnny Walker and the Glenrothes, along with a copy of The Legend of Laphroaig, signed by John Campbell. I'm also going to throw in some prizes from my photo collection and the swag box as well. All you have to do is be a subscriber to the WhiskeyCast email newsletter, click the like button on the Facebook page, or follow me on Twitter, or you can post feedback at the iTunes Music Store or the Android Market. I'll pick winners at random on Father's Day, 2 weeks from now. By the way, there's another new episode of WhiskeyCast HD available. If you remember my visit to Taiwan's King Car and Cavalan Distillery back in April, this week's episode features a look inside the distillery and what makes things pretty unique at Cavalan. It's now available in the iTunes Music Store, and I'm really proud to say it's being featured this week on the store's main podcast page in the New and Noteworthy section. Let's take a look at the emails of the week now, brought to you this time around by Highland Park. Getting a lot of nice comments on WhiskeyCast HD, Terry Lozoff in Boston posted on Twitter that he's, quote, really digging the HD. It's nice to finally get the video along with the voice. Benjamin Chen in Singapore has already watched the Cavalan episode of WhiskeyCast HD, and on the Facebook page he called it a fortunate coincidence since he's heading to Taiwan next month for a holiday and will make a trip to Yilan to visit the distillery. Benjamin wanted to know who he should contact to make arrangements for a tour. Well, there's no arrangements needed. The distillery is wide open to the public and gets around 1 million visitors every year. John Resurrection has a busy weekend planned this weekend, and he emailed earlier in the week for some advice. Hi, Mark. Here's my issue. In January, I signed up for a 100-mile bicycle ride in Lake Tahoe, California, through the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society's Team and Training Program. Since then, I've been raising money and training every Saturday and Tuesday in preparation. Well, the time has come, and this coming Sunday, June 5th, I'll be attempting my first 100-mile ride. Now that you have the backstory, here's where the whiskey part comes in. I would like to toast my accomplishment at the finish line with some Brooklottie Black Art that I purchased several months back but have not opened while I waited for the right occasion. However, I need to pack this bottle in my checked baggage. Have you ever traveled with your whiskey? Is there anything I should be worried about? Any advice from you would be great. By the way, I plan on taking a photo and sending it along to Jim McEwen. Well, first off, good luck and have fun, John. This is going to be a great experience for you. I've already shared my tips with John via email, but I've been lucky enough so far to never have a bottle break in travel, knock wood. But what I do is wrap a bottle in clothing and place it in the middle of my suitcase with clothing all around it. I also use a folding garment bag on some of my trips, and I put bottles in right before I zip it and fold it closed. That way those bottles are right in the middle and protected on all four sides. Now, this is something I'll probably do a WhiskeyCast HD piece on in the near future, since it's something I get asked about several times a year. If you have a question or a suggestion, I'd love to hear from you. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and you can post comments at the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. Finally, I need to address a comment that a gentleman in London posted on the Facebook page that belongs to a friend of my daughter. Lawrence Jones III in London disagreed with my daughter's friend Jonathan's kind words about WhiskeyCast, and Lawrence accused me of, quote, not doing justice to the Orkney and Islay malts. Lawrence, if you're listening, the last two episodes had interviews on Islay whiskeys, and we did 10 shows last year in 10 days from the Islay Festival of Malt and Music. And as for Orkney, the emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Highland Park.
Hello, this is Jerry Tosh of Highland Park, the makers of the best spirit in the world. If you'd like to go onto the WhiskeyCast website and click on the banner, then it'll take you to the inner circle and sign up, and we'll send you as much information about Highland Park as you'd ever need to know.
Okay, snarky time over. Let's get to the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. The Dundee Dell in Omaha, Nebraska has single malt tastings coming up June 5th and 9th. Woodford Reserve's final Bourbon Academy class of the year is next Saturday at the distillery in Versailles, Kentucky, along with the monthly second Saturday single malt tasting at the Miner's Delight Inn in Atlantic City, Wyoming. McTeers will hold its next whiskey auction June 15th in Glasgow. Bonhams will hold one a week later on the 22nd in Edinburgh. The Whiskey Guild will hold its next Whiskey Classic tasting cruise on June 23rd in Washington, D.C. And this year's edition of the Malts Cruise sets sail from Oban on July 8th for 2 full weeks of sailing along the Scottish coast. You'll find a full calendar of events on the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay. This week's WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Glengarry. Last time around, I mentioned the Balcones Brimstone Corn Whiskey from Texas and how the grain was dried over burning Texas scrub oak. Turns out, I was wrong. Chip Tate of Balcones Distillery doesn't smoke the grain. He smokes the whiskey itself. That's just one thing that makes this Texas distillery unique.
There's two answers, basically, because I get that question a lot. The first is very carefully. And the second is none of your damn business.
Okay.
It's a somewhat secretive process that we do that involves actually getting the smoke directly into the whiskey. So we're not, the corn is the corn is roasted like all of our corn is that we use in the whiskey, but it's actually the whiskey to which we're adding the smoke and not the corn, not the grain.
So I can't even imagine how you would do this, and I know you're not going to tell me anyway, but what kind of flavor does this impart to the whiskey? Because I don't recall anybody else ever trying this one before.
Well, yeah, I'm not aware of anybody doing that either. It's really nice. It's a little hard to describe. I guess the best way to describe it is somewhat like a cold smoked meat, a long cold smoked meat, that the smoke flavor is fairly intense, but in a very nuanced way. So it's something that a lot of people, you know, say 3 or 4 out of 10, taste it, love it from the first sip. There's always the 1 in 10 that for any whiskey or whatever, you say, that's not my thing. But the others taste it, and they're kind of taken aback the first sip. And they take another sip, and what scared them off nearly the first sip unfolds into all these other flavors. And most people end up hooked, because it's not barely smoky. I mean, it's definitely, we can kind of tell from the name Brimstone. I mean, we're not looking for to only be subtle. I'll say that, but
it wouldn't be Texas if it was subtle.
Well, there you go. But it's definitely nuanced underneath. It's a very round, full smoke flavor, not a peat smoke flavor. That's another thing, is that I've been surprised about how many people have liked it, how many people who don't like Isla whiskeys. And just so you know, I love Isla whiskeys, so I'm not picking on Isla whiskeys. It's just, it's not every person's whiskey.
They are an acquired taste, it's fair to say.
Right. And the other thing that's very interesting to me, you know, if I study the physiology of taste, is that if you picture a room full of people sipping Isla whiskeys, you probably aren't picturing women, you know, 25 to 35. But
I'd argue that point with you, because I know a lot of women in that age group who do like Islas. But
maybe I'm just wrong. Maybe I have because what I well, for whatever reason, maybe it was just a misconception.
Or women in Texas just haven't discovered it yet.
What's that?
Or women in Texas just haven't discovered it yet.
Well, I think, you know, I think there are a lot of whiskey drinkers out there that don't know they're whiskey drinkers yet. Some of my business partners are always asking me, you know, what's this big Irish whiskey thing? And I say, well, you know, I'm not trying to pick on Irish whiskey, but I think it's the beginning of the road for a lot of new whiskey drinkers. It's a fairly approachable whiskey. I think there are a lot of new whiskey drinkers coming on board. It's kind of gone through its, this is an old man's drink phase into a renewal. So,
I like the way you put that there are whiskey drinkers who just don't know they're whiskey drinkers yet. I like
it. Yeah, I mean, I think that's coming. I think it's something you thought, you know, well, my grandfather drinks scotch. I'm not really a whiskey guy. I think there's a whole broad range of whiskeys that are available now that weren't as readily available. I mean, as of the 70s, you had a few single malts in this country, but nothing like the selection you've got now.
So, on the smoking process here, the question I've got is, what would the difference be between the scrub oak you're using, and maybe you should explain what scrub oak is just for folks who have not been in Texas.
Right.
And for the record, I spent 5 years in Houston, so I can... So I've had a little experience with the Hill Country and all.
Yeah.
But what the difference would be between that and, say, if you smoked it with mesquite?
The scrub oak is a native tree in several senses, and not just that it grows naturally here, the species, but the importance of the scrub aspect is it's stuff that's growing unassisted and unirrigated pasture land. And so it's stuff that's really fighting tooth and nail to survive. So I guess you could almost draw a parallel to, you know, good wine grapes, that many of the things that a potato farmer, for instance, might do to maximize yield and so forth, a wine grower doesn't do. They, you know, cut bunches off and they don't irrigate as much. They want an intensity of flavor that comes with a little bit of struggle. And it's a similar sort of thing, I think, that goes on with the scrub oak. This is what ranchers pay people or allow them to take off their land for free, because to graze cattle here, you need a whole lot of land because there isn't a whole lot of water. This is in England, so you don't need to have nearly as much grass per acre. And so mesquite, oak, all of those things are just taking up available sun and water, so they get them cleared off their land. So it's a really gnarly, you know, crooked, full-flavored wood.
Ugly tree, but it adds a lot of flavor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's... Isn't that how it goes? The uglier it is, the more interesting you need to be. You always look for the distiller's bottle. It's all scuffed up and has the Sharpie marker on it. It's hidden under the shelf. And everybody says, oh, you don't try that.
Oh, yes, you do.
Oh, yes, you do.
Now, tell me about the blue corn, because as near as I can tell, you guys are about the only ones in the country that are using blue corn as well in this process. And I know that adds a different flavor, too, right?
It does. And it has to do with the style of whiskey that we're making. You know, the concept of the distillery, first off, is not just make whiskey in Texas, but make Texas styles of whiskey. And so then the obvious question comes, well, what is that? We're trying to define that, you know, whether we're successful or not. Only time will tell. But the particular story with the corn is that I've historically been more of a malt guy than a corn whiskey guy. Now, I don't dislike bourbon. I like bourbon, and there are a number of bourbons and rye whiskeys that I just absolutely love. But, you know, kind of being of the French school of cooking and the Scottish school of distilling, one criticism or comment you can make of bourbon is that it's got to be at least 51% corn, but it doesn't taste like corn at all. Now, the response to that is, well, that's just the style. It's not supposed to taste like corn. That's kind of the backdrop on which the bourbon picture is painted. But the concept of what we're trying to do is create a Texas corn whiskey style that is just as aged and elegant and refined, if not more so, than a bourbon. So it's not moonshine, but it tastes like corn. So not a bourbon, not a moonshine, aged corn whiskey that brings out the inherent flavor of the corn. So back to your question, why the blue corn? I decided if I was going to try to make that kind of whiskey, that I wanted to use the richest, most flavorful corn I could get my hands on. So we started with, you know, blind taste tests of just about everything. I mean, we used Jiffy Pop. I didn't care what one, as long as it was the best. And it was kind of cool that one of the country's oldest, well, one of the world's oldest types of corn, you know, the native blue corn here, is what, especially once roasted, seemed to have the most character and full corn flavor.
We know about the blue corn, and then you've also got that in your baby blue whiskey, which was the younger stuff, right?
It is younger in a way. More specifically, it's a profile. So many of the whiskeys in the Baby Blue aren't necessarily younger or older. So on the whole, it is. But what I'm getting at is it's a particular fresh, youthful character, which you rarely get in older barrels, but sometimes, that we're really trying to portray in the Baby Blue. The True Blue characterizes the sort of older, richer, it's a different corn profile that you get with age, although there are also some young barrels in there. We're really big on non-age statements in terms of we look at each barrel for what it is, when it is. And there's some barrels that are quite young that, although they're different than the older barrels, in many ways are better. It just, you know, each barrel has its place. But, yes, the Brimstone is a more mature, I guess you could say, expression of a lot of the corn whiskeys that I felt went better with the sweetness of the smoke and the wood.
before I get into your single malts, and I know that'll have a lot of people interested that you're making Texas single malts, tell me how you guys got started in all this, because I know you actually built the entire plant yourselves, right? You didn't go out to a still maker. You guys actually did all the hammering and tin bending yourselves, right, with the copper?
Yeah, that's right. You know, part of that was financial in terms of the still builders out there make a good living, and they deserve to do so. But the other part of it is there are a lot of unique things that I wanted in our distillery, both to make it fit in the space that we have, which at this point is pretty small, and also to produce a certain kind of product. So it took about a year for us to design and build the distillery. We need to do pretty extensive work on the building as well, you know, plumbing, electric, re-roof the place, remove a lot of walls and reframe it, and then we could start building equipment. But it really makes us, lets us make things the way we want to. Someday I look forward to having some stills that somebody else built, because it's no small thing. But
what did it teach you about the process?
I mean, I think it really teaches you there's no better way to get a direct feel for how equipment, including how it's fired and all these different things, affects the whiskey that comes off the stills. You know, because I'm the one who built it, I'm the one who's tweaked it or repaired it. Every design decision is known very explicitly to me, so every time, you know, and both for my own, you know, product development and even training distillers, it's a really unique place to be able to learn how to make whiskey, because, at least in my experience, it's very rare that you have an opportunity to sit down and learn about how something is designed, why it's designed that way, help build it that way, then use it the way it was designed, taste the whiskey coming off the stills, taste the whiskey when it's matured. You know, there's a really start-to-finish approach that normally doesn't include the equipment itself that distillers get here.
How did you get into the distilling business to begin with?
It really started with a love of cooking. I started getting serious about cooking when I was around 11, and that first bloomed into a love of baking, and I baked pretty seriously, not professionally, but just, you know, mad scientist taking over the kitchen kind of baking for probably 20 years. Somewhere in there, approaching my 21st birthday, I got that transition into brewing. And that's what I really focused on and actually intended to start a commercial brewery. Did some commercial brewing off and on. But as I was kind of waiting for just the right moment, maritally, financially, all those different things, my taste really, I became more of a whiskey drinker than a beer drinker. I still enjoy beer, but normally when I want to have a drink, and when I, you know, what magazines do I follow, all that, I'm most intrigued with whiskeys.
Yeah, you have to be able to drink beer in Texas because it's 100 degrees outside, and sometimes you have to have
hydrated.
A cold beer.
Yeah, you got to stay hydrated,
yeah.
Right? You know, the funny thing that wasn't the cause of it, but it was a funny sort of coincidence. As I was getting ready in my own mind to start this brewery, I decided to get some professional training. And again, I was kind of limited. I was married to a professor at the time and couldn't just go anywhere anytime. So the best option, it seemed, was to study for the Institute. It was the Institute of Brewing exam at the time. Well-recognized credential, the diploma exam, and something that you could actually do without being away for weeks and weeks. You had to prepare for months and months, but you didn't have to go somewhere for a course. So as I'm preparing over, say, 18 months for this exam, get a very typically dry British memo, you know, for various financial and organizational reasons, the Guild of Distillers will be combining with the Institute of Brewing, blah, 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 blah. Okay. There will be a new section on your exam. So that kind of jumps out. You're like, whoa. So I'm kind of freaked out at first. Yeah, because I'm like, I don't know anything about the distilling. Because they were just trying to handle the transition. At this point now, there's a diploma exam in distilling and a diploma exam in brewing, but this change was happening just a matter of months before the annual exam. So I'm sure this was tried sort of an accommodation to make the guild not feel like the redheaded stepchild with the organization. Anyway, so I get the new syllabus, and it's all engineering. And as it happens, kind of in a previous life, I used to do a bit of engineering, nuclear engineering, and so, you know, all this stainless alloys and fluid dynamics and emissivity and all, I was like, okay, well, that's no big deal. I can handle that.
Wait a second. A nuclear engineer turned distiller.
Well, not exactly. I said I worked in the nuclear engineer. I was a physics geek on my way to becoming a nuclear engineer and actually worked for a nuclear engineering company.
Oh, okay.
I would not call myself an actual fully qualified nuclear engineer.
Okay.
I was on my way toward that when about midway through college, I said, no, I don't think I'll get a physics degree. I'll get a philosophy degree. So, you know, the company that was sponsoring me, for which I was working during the summers and all that, didn't quite have to do with that, but I still continue to work with them, and, you know, a lot of the experience I had in that industry was through that scholarship. But, yeah, physics and engineering was not something I was entirely uncomfortable with.
Okay.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of philosophy in whiskey that tend to go hand in hand.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of a really weird educational background until you see the distilling, and then it all makes perfect sense. You know, somebody, physics geek turned philosopher, who then ended up going to seminary and then doing a number of different things, starting his own business. It makes perfect, you know, it's very meditative, physics-based, chemistry-based profession. So... it all kind of all came together in the distillery.
Now, where are your whiskeys available?
Right now, they are available in a handful of available in the UK, in California, very limited degree in Oregon, in Louisiana, Illinois, Delaware, Connecticut, D.C., Florida, and probably one or two other states that I'm forgetting at the moment because they're new.
Now let's talk about those single malts. What makes a Texas single malt different from any other single malt, especially the way you guys make them?
Well, that's kind of a difficult question to answer in a way. In some regards, not very much. In terms of the process, is actually very similar to a traditional Scottish single malt process. Anyone acquainted with Scottish single malt in different distilleries know that there's a wide variety of whiskeys that come out from a number of different distilleries that have a very similar process with a few differences along the way that can make all the difference in the end whiskey. Our barrel aging methods are a little bit different in terms of the wood that I use. There's some new wood and the size of the barrels and a number of other things. But the best way to really understand the difference would be to try it. It probably has, some people comment and say it reminds them a bit of some Japanese whiskeys. Not to say it tastes like Japanese whiskey, but that it reminds them more of some Japanese whiskeys than of Scotland per se. But again, it's there's a nice sort of very floral, fruity, apple spice, mincemeat note in the aroma. It's a very soft, approachable malt, but very full of flavor.
And you've got a peated one, too. Where do you get your peat from?
Well, we're going to have a peated one at some point. We need to update our website quite a bit.
Okay, I saw it listed on the website. That's why I was asking about it.
Yeah, neither malt is actually out yet. We're going to be putting one of those malts out at some unspecified point in the future. So that's, you know, something to be on the lookout for. But, you know, I kind of learned my lesson with the Betty Blue in terms of what can happen if things go well, in terms of not being ready and not having enough.
Right.
Yeah, we couldn't keep up. We actually had to stop distribution about 5 or 6 weeks in because the orders were growing so fast that, you know, I had to explain to distributors, it's not just that I don't have mature product. I mean, you're actually ordering more. If I dumped every barrel, including the ones that I filled yesterday, I still couldn't fill your order. So, you know, that was great, but it was, growth is probably the biggest challenge that we face. It's kind of funny when you go into all of this, the problems that you worry about, right? The obvious things, like, can I actually successfully build a distillery, even though I've never done that before? Or can I create these new styles of whiskey? Will they be well received? And all that can be going well, which it has been so far. But growth for a real bootstrap business, I mean, it's tough because you're having to make 4 and 5 times more whiskey than you're selling, which means the better you do, the broker you are. So, you know, that's been something we have to be careful about. It's a challenge because we're trying to produce malt in quantity. Of course, the more malt we produce that we aren't selling, that's a financial challenge. And then, but you want to have a certain number of barrels that you feel like are mature before you release it in case things go the way you hope they do. So we're trying to balance all that.
These are lessons that are important, especially with more and more folks getting into micro distilling and joining you guys in this business. One of the things I noticed on the website was that you guys did not get into this to realize a profit dream, but to realize a distilling dream, right?
Right.
What do folks who are trying to say, I want to start a distillery, what do they need to know, and what can they learn from what you guys have done?
I don't know. I feel like in some ways it's kind of like having kids, that it's more about knowing that somebody has the right intentions and maybe some talent. And a lot of other things, you could kind of say, well, you think you're ready, and you're not. But that's okay. Like, you probably wouldn't jump and do this if you really knew what you were doing. But once you realize that, you'll be glad you did. You know, it's like having kids. Like, you're in over your head in a way that you don't really know. Well, you kind of know when you have them. But that doesn't mean that you regret getting into it. I mean, I would say that being well prepared and knowing how to make whiskey is a really good place to start. And that sounds like a very obvious thing, but I would say that the craft whiskey industry is still in its technical infancy in terms of a lot of the stuff that I see out there. Because it's a dicey enough business as it is to... Is there a problem? What's the problem?
The corn mash is going in the drain, and that's just running the water, and then you also mentioned the smoker out there.
Okay. Sorry, I just had somebody from the city stop by.
Uh-oh.
The city is always helping us out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, being well-versed with what's out there already and having somewhat of an idea about what it is that you want to produce. Those are good places to start. Like many projects like this, you're going to need a lot more money than you think, way more money than you think, because, you know, you kind of figure in a way that it's a very rapidly growing business or sector, as you mentioned, and one result of that is you either tend to drown or soar quickly, and both of those can be a problem, different problems. But, you know, having some sort of plan about how you're going to not lose distributors when they want, you know, 2 and 3 times more what you can produce,
right.
You know, what's the plan there?
you mentioned your visit from the city just a second ago. For those who don't know, how's your relationship with the community? Because Waco is not exactly known as probably, well, it's the home of Baylor University, for one, people who are not familiar with Waco, which is a school that, shall we say, would probably be one of the drier schools around, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
How's your relationship with the town? How do they view having a distillery right in the middle of town?
Yeah, actually, Waco's been really supportive. I was almost a little surprised. I actually worked at Baylor not too long ago. You know, the best way I can describe it is that, first of all, the moderate Baptists have moderated a little bit in the last 10 or 15 years, and that their views on drinking and dancing and all of that are not what they used to be. But probably the bigger point is that as much as they may not be sure about what they think about drinking and dancing, they don't want anybody else telling them what they think about drinking and dancing. And so, the one or two times at most that someone has commented, oh, great, you know, this is just what we need, you know, an alcohol den of sin and so forth. There have been a dozen or two dozen people that will go on some blog afterwards and anywhere from the soft, well, you don't understand, it's not really what it's about, and it's kind of art, to, you know, you ignorant son of a bitch. People like you is what's wrong with the world today. You know, I don't even drink whiskey. I'm going to go buy two cases right now. there's a real reaction against that kind of what's viewed as overly conservative knee-jerk reaction to things. And I think that also Wacoans are proud and glad to see a business doing well. It's kind of interesting. We use, you know, spring water from here. Waco is not known for its water quality, but actually some of the best spring water in the state, I think, comes from Waco. So we've had our struggles with the city just because I think my guess is because they know very little about how a distillery works, it makes them nervous because they don't know how to find out more. And it's sort of their job not to trust us. So their answer to many things ends up being no, and I have to sort of push them to say, well, you can't just say no. You need to say, you can't do it this way, but there's got to be some other way we can do it.
It's going so back to that parenting thing. It's the because I said so thing.
Yeah. You know, and it's, you know, it's a very delicate process because on the one hand, you have to push them past just doing nothing. On the other hand, you don't want to challenge the local sheriff, if you know what I mean, because
mm-hmm.
you may win the battle, but you will lose the war.
But of course, they've also realized that there's tax revenue to be made off you guys, so it's better to
The thing to understand though is the people. Government doesn't work like business. The people who are actually responsible for collecting the tax revenue are not really the same who regulate other things. So, in other words, even the federal government that by far collects the most revenue from us isn't always the most helpful in helping us get an additional license or whatever the case is. It's relatively new thing that there are all these, so many distilleries. You know, the total alcohol production in this country probably hasn't gone up very much at all because the volumes were so large, but the total number of whiskey distilleries has probably tripled or quadrupled over the last 10 years because of the craft distilling movement. So there are all kinds of unique problems that surround that in terms of working with the government and helping them understand what you're about.
How often do you get somebody coming down and asking if they can hang out with you guys and learn about distilling?
I mean, we get intern applications pretty regularly. You know, tours will happen anywhere from once a week to four or five times a week. But then we'll get people who want to come for a handful of months. Pretty regular streams. They tend to come in waves for whatever reason. We'll kind of get 8 or 10 at a time, and there'll be a lull, and be one or two. But we've quite had quite a number of interns.
We've talked about the heat down there. How's your angel share? Because I know it can get bloody hot down there in the summertime, and it can get pretty cold in the winter times too. So how happy are the angels down around your warehouse?
Oh, they're real happy. You know, but for different reasons. We have a new building that we're going to be using for storage as soon as we can clear it with the city, back to that point. It's only taken 5 months so far. But right now, everything's all in one building. And so the heat isn't that much of a factor in the sense that we, you know, they're in an air-conditioned space. What really, we use smaller barrels, though, and intentionally cycle them up and down, or at least knowingly cycle them up and down in temperature, which is the reason our angel share is so large. As a result, that pushes the whiskey deep into the wood as the barrels warm up, and then pulls that whiskey back into the wood along with some air as they cool down, and really speed the maturation quite a bit. But we lose quite a bit more than other folks do.
How much fun are you guys having doing this? Because it sounds like it's got to be a lot of fun.
You know, it is a lot of fun. It's really exciting. It depends on the day. It depends on whether or not the city has just come in and caused some sort of problem. You know, but as soon as you clear that off your mental plate, no, I mean, it's great. It's wonderful to do the work that we do. I love the variety of what a typical day has in it, and then of course looking back on what we're doing and what we have done, there's a tremendous sense of satisfaction with, you know, even not that we made it, but having made it this far, you know, that we have a working distillery, that we have some labels out there that people are seeming to enjoy, that are pretty unique. I think that's really satisfying. So we're having a good time.
You'll find a link to the Balcones Distillery website at the WhiskeyCast website, and I'm busy trying to track down a bottle of Balcones Brimstone. I'll have the tasting notes for it when I do. In the meantime, let's look at a couple of other craft whiskeys to start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department. Phil Brandon at Rocktown Distillery in Little Rock, Arkansas, sent me a sample of his Arkansas Lightning Spirit to taste. It's distilled from a mash of corn and wheat, bottled at 62.5% ABV, just like it would if it were going into a barrel to be aged as bourbon. The nose has a pretty strong alcohol burn, of course, but also reminded me of corn on the cob, along with some hints of butter, sugar, and raisins. The taste starts off with that same alcohol burn, followed by a slight tartness and a touch of raisins, and the finish is pretty clean and dry. I'd like to try this one after 2 or 3 years in wood to see how it matures, but right now it's pretty similar to a lot of unaged white whiskeys. It's drinkable, but preferably with some water or in a cocktail. On its own, I'm giving Arkansas Lightning a 79. Out west in Washington, the guys at Dry Fly Distilling have produced a 100% wheat whiskey from locally grown crops. It's 2 years old and bottled at 40% ABV. The nose is warming with a good balance of caramel syrup and dark chocolate against cinnamon, allspice, and nutmeg notes. The taste has a good thick mouthfeel, and the cinnamon spice builds up nicely without overpowering notes of oak, caramel, and a hint of peppercorns. The finish is dry with touches of oak and peppercorns, and I'm scoring the Dry Fly Wheat Whiskey an 84. Napaug Castle recently released its first Irish single malt with a cask finish. Twinwood is 16 years old with the first 15 years in ex-bourbon casks, followed by a final spell in sherry casks. It's bottled at 40% ABV. The nose is complex and malty, with dried apricots and apples and a hint of roasted almonds. The taste is rich and spicy, with strong cinnamon surrounded by nuttiness, dark chocolate, and caramel notes. The finish has a touch of malt and a slight citrus tartness balanced against dark chocolate. I'm giving the Napaug Castle Twinwood a score of 89. Of course, you'll find all of my tasting notes in the free WhiskeyCast smartphone apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android, and at the WhiskeyCast website, too. That's also where you'll find links to the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com, WhiskeyCast HD, and a complete archive of past audio episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. I'd love to hear from you. Whiskey Cast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.